slope, and the forest began to change. The ground beneath his feet became damp, then marshy. Peter splashed across a muddy creek, then skirted around several weedy bogs. Squat, twisted trees grew up from murky, misty pools, their bark slick, black, and oily, thick moss dripping from their branches. The dim light filtering through their brown, yellowy leaves cast everything in a shadowy amber glow. The delicate scents of flowers and berries were replaced by the sweet, spicy smell of fluff mud and the playful bird calls with croaks and deep bellows. Peter stopped. He'd lost any sign of the girls. He noticed the little flying people were no longer following him and realized he was alone. Something splashed nearby, and Peter jumped. He decided he must have gone the wrong way and started to retrace his steps. There they were, the three girls, as though they'd materialized out of the musky air. They stood in front of the cascading leaves of a huge weeping willow, just staring at him, their faces somber.
"Where'd you go?"
he began, then caught movement behind them. Someone was with them. The shadowy shape of a woman slipped out from the curtain of leaves. Peter stepped back, his hand dropping to the hilt of his knife.
"A grown-up!"
he hissed. She was stout but curvy, wide through the hips and thighs. The light danced across her face, revealing smoky, heavy eyelids and luminous, swamp-green eyes. Peter started to run when she called his name, her voice throaty, barely more than a whisper. Yet he heard her well, as though she were beside him. He hesitated.
"You're most welcome here, sweet boy."
Her deep, rich voice blanketed him, comforting, soothing, chasing away his fears. She stepped forward into a soft ray of sunlight, the light glittering off her dark, oily skin. Peter looked closer. Her skin was actually green, the deep, dark emerald of evergreen leaves. Her hair was green as well, a darker shade, almost black. It flowed from beneath a skull cap drawn forward into a widow's peak across her forehead. The twisting weaves of hair snaked down almost to her knees and draped across her face like a hood, keeping all but her large eyes in shadow. Her thin, smoky robe clung to her like a spiderweb, dripping from her in ropey strings, doing little to cover her full breasts and the shadowy tuft between her legs. Bronze bracelets jangled from her wrists and ankles, and a necklace of bone and claws hung about her neck. She smiled at Peter, strolled over to him, and slid an arm around his shoulders. Her breath was hot. It smelled of honey, and when he inhaled, he felt a drowsy warmth take him.
"Won't you come in?"
She gestured to a round hole dug into an embankment beneath a thick overhang of straw and matted moss. Large pitted stones circled the entrance, each with the face of a brooding beast carved into its surface. Dozens of dried gourds hung around the opening, painted red, with bird-size holes cut into them. Small, black bat-winged men-shaped creatures with long scorpion tails were perched or zipping in and out of them. It didn't look like any place Peter wanted to go. He shook his head.
"I have fresh baked gingerbread. All little boys like gingerbread, don't they?"
The three girls nodded.
"Most certainly they do, Mother."
The woman put her full, wet lips to his ear, whispered to him. The words were all gibberish to Peter, a strange song of curt, cutting sounds, but the smell of baking bread and honey suddenly came alive. Peter's stomach growled and his mouth moistened. He licked his lips. He would really like some gingerbread, whatever that was.
"Come along,"
she murmured, and ducked into the hole. Peter didn't think it would be a good idea to follow the woman into that hole, didn't think it would be a good idea to follow her anywhere, but his mind felt syrupy and slow. And when the three girls took his hands and pulled him along, he followed. He stooped to avoid bumping the roots and glowing mushrooms as he stumbled drunkenly down the long burrow. The tunnel opened up into a small cavern of black rock and twisting roots. Amber stones burned beneath a stack of branches in a wide earthen fireplace, bathing the cavern in their soft caramel glow. Peter's foot caught on a hide and he fell sprawling atop a pile of plush furs. Bones, feathers, beads, dried flowers, and a variety of animal skulls were strung together and dangled from the ceiling on long cords. Fat black toads, great oily beetles, and colorful birds hung upside down from hooks, staring at him with dead, glassy eyes. Scrolls and clay pots lay scattered about on low-lying tables. Peter caught movement among the crags and crevasses of the cavern, thought he saw shapes crawling within the shadows. Then he spied the pile of little cakes stacked in a clay bowl and could think of little else. She crawled across the furs, carrying the bowl, sidling up next to him. She slid a bare leg over him and put a cake to his lips. Peter took a bite. It was sweet and warm, but oddly gooey in the middle. He ate it anyway, then another. Wanted more, but was having trouble chewing, having trouble keeping his head up. The room was growing fuzzy, wobbling somehow, like ripples across a pond. One moment he saw dozens of shiny candles flickering down at him. Then he'd blink, and in their stead would be eyes. Hundreds of slanted yellow eyes. She straddled him, leaning forward, letting her hair drape across his face. She placed a warm hand on his stomach, running her fingers up his chest, pushing the wolf pelt aside. She bent over and sniffed his hair, her breasts sliding along his bare chest as she sniffed his face, down his neck, then pressed her cheek against his chest. He felt the hot wetness of her mouth on his nipple. Peter felt his loins stir. He saw the three sisters behind the woman, watching, their eyes wide, feverous, drool running shamelessly down their chins.
"My, he is a firm one," whispered the first.
"Rigid as a tent post," chimed in the second. "We will feed a long time on this one," added the third, and all three giggled.
"No,"
Peter tried to shout, but managed only a weak moan. He felt a sharp sting, then a burning at his nipple.
"Blood for the children, blood for all," the sisters said as one.
Peter caught movement above him. Eyes, the yellow slanted eyes slithering out from the shadows. Hundreds of them, twisted, deformed creatures, some no bigger than newts, others the size of raccoons. Blotchy gray skin rolled along their bony, cadaverous bodies as they slithered and shimmied toward him, all grinning with long, needle-thin teeth. He caught sight of the bowl of gingerbread cakes, only they weren't cakes at all, but fat, grubby larvae with little black heads. Again, Peter tried to shout. The woman convulsed, coughed violently, and sat up. Blood was smeared all around her lips and mouth.
"Mother, what is it?"
the sisters asked as one. She coughed again, a retching cough. She clutched her throat, gagged, and spat up, dousing Peter with a mouthful of bile and blood. She howled, the horrible sound filling the small chamber. The creatures froze in place, their eyes terrified.
She stared at Peter while a long string of red drool slid from her lips.
It can't be.
She shook her head.
How?
She coughed again, spattered Peter's face with more blood.
Mother, what is it? The sisters pleaded. Tell us.
The woman pushed the wolf cap back from Peter's head. She stared at his ears.
Not a boy, she said,
her eyes wide with confusion and fear before they turned hard.
Not a child of the she, either.
An abomination,
she hissed. Peter felt himself waking up fast, the room coming into sharp focus. Her hand shot out like a viper, clutching his neck between her rigid fingers, her sharp nails biting into his flesh.
Where did you come from? Did Modron send you? Is this one of her games?
Peter slid his hand down to his knife, but found the sheath empty.
Is this her vexings?
She cried, her emerald eyes swimming with malice.
Answer me, lest I bite off your boyhood and feed you to the leeches.
Peter's hand flailed about, hit the clay bowl. He snatched a hold of it and struck her, breaking the bowl on the side of her head, knocking her over. Peter kicked away and almost made it to his feet when her fingers bit into his ankle, tripping him, sending him barreling into the hearth. She came after him, claws out, lips peeled back, exposing rows of long, green, blood-stained teeth. Her eyes shriveled to tiny pinpricks of glowing green set deep within dark sockets. She snatched a hold of his arm, her sharp claws puncturing deep into his muscle tissue. She raked her other hand across his ribs, tearing into his flesh. Peter let out a shrill cry and snatched a shard of timber from the fire, cried out again from the heat of it, but held tight as he rammed the burning end into her eye. She shrieked, a sound so loud that he had to clap his hands over his ears. She flew away from him, crashing across the room, the burning shard stuck deep in her socket, sizzling flames leaping up between her fingers as she clutched at it. Peter didn't wait around to see what happened next. He dove into the tunnel, scrambling up the shaft as fast as a mole rat.
Get him!
She wailed.
Get him! Get him!
She bellowed, and her voice shot up the tunnel, sending leaves, dirt, and bugs rocketing past him in a hot blast. Every slithering, crawling, and flying thing, the very cavern itself, seemed to howl then. And they came for him, all of them. The roots, too, grabbing at his arms and legs. The tunnel shrank around him like the convulsing throat of some giant monstrosity. Things leaped off the walls onto him. Bugs, spiders. He felt their stings and bites. He reached the surface and the bat-winged creatures came for him like a swarm of hornets, stinging him with their tails, sending him howling away into the thickets. Peter ran then, ran faster than he'd ever run. He had no idea where he was going, intent only on getting as far away as he could from that woman, that creature, and all the biting, stinging things. He heard howls and dared a glance back. The three girls were coming for him, running on all fours, great loping strides. Their feet seemed not to even touch the ground, long, pointed tongues lolling out from between sharp canine teeth as they rapidly closed the distance. Peter broke out of the thicket onto a small path and dashed up the trail. He climbed steadily upward, the bog falling behind as the ground became firm underfoot. A figure stepped in front of him. A man? Peter crashed headlong into him, both of them tumbling into a small grassy clearing. Peter hopped up, started to flee, and saw more men. Five, no, six of them. They pointed long, thin swords at his chest. Peter glanced around, frantically searching for an avenue of escape.
"Whoa, hold,"
said the first man, the one Peter had knocked over.
"What nonsense is going on here?"
On second look, Peter realized that these were not men, not of the sorts he'd known anyway. In fact, they were elves, but Peter knew nothing about elves at the time. These elves were much shorter than men, boyish in size, little over a head taller than himself. Long in limb, thin of face, almost feminine, with small golden eyes, mere slits, slanted and set high and wide above sharp cheekbones. They had pointed ears and skin as white as chalk. Their hair hung down their backs in long braids. They wore tight-fitting garments that looked to be made of woven leaves and bark.
"Give him back," came a little girl's voice.
The three sisters were standing at the edge of the clearing, not 10 yards away. The elves shifted the points of their swords to the girls.
"We brought him through," the girls spoke. "He's ours."
"I think not," said the elf, the one Peter had run into.
Peter could see he looked older than the others. His hair was pure white, and there were strong lines about his eyes. The elf got to his feet, drew his sword, and stepped in front of Peter. The sisters hissed, all three of them raking the air with their claws as though they couldn't wait to rend Peter's flesh.
"He belongs to me," came a deep, guttural voice from behind the girls.
The elves exchanged looks. The woman strolled into the clearing, one hand clasped over her eye.
"He owes me something."
She dropped her hand, exposing the raw, bloody wound of her eyeless socket. Several of the elves gasped, but held their ground.
"You're trespassing, all of you. Give me one of the boy's eyes and I will allow you to leave unharmed."
"Nonsense,"
countered a voice from behind Peter. Another woman entered the clearing. She was a bit taller than the swamp woman, thin-boned and slender through the body, almost frail, her smooth skin so white as to be blue. Her long white hair was tied back and crowned with a ring of holly leaves. She was draped in shimmering white and gold and wore a bronze star attached around her neck by a simple gold chain.
"This is Mirkvjor Forest," she said. "You've no dominion here. Go back to your hole and rot with your filthy beasts."
The swamp woman smirked.
"What do you know of rotting, you with your cold, dead cunt?"
The white-haired woman's eyes flashed, brilliant cerulean. The swamp woman laughed.
"A barren fertility goddess. No wonder you can no longer hear father's voice."
A low growl rumbled from the white-haired woman's throat, a sound that made the hair stand up on Peter's arms. She stepped forward, her lips peeled back, exposing long canine fangs, appearing more animal than human at that moment.
"Oh, stop your pissing, Modron," the swamp woman said. "If you wish this creature, take him."
The swamp woman's face changed then. Peter wasn't sure if he saw sympathy or pity, maybe both.
"How many?" she asked. "How many will it take to fill that hole in your heart? You can have all the children in our world and in theirs, but it will never bring your little boy back to you."
Pain, deep pain, fell across the white-haired lady's face. The swamp woman started away, then stopped. She looked at Peter.
"Be careful, little boy.
I only want your eye."
"But she'll take your soul."
The swamp woman spun away and seemed to evaporate into the woods. The three sisters backed slowly away, not taking their eyes off Peter. Before the last sister left, she pointed at Peter, then at her eye, and jabbed at the air with a hook claw. The cerulean-eyed woman stared at Peter. They all did. Peter glanced about, looking for an escape.
"Don't be frightened, boy," said the older elf as he dusted off his leggings. "Anyone that stole the witch's very eye has nothing to fear from the likes of us."
He gave Peter a wry smile of admiration. The other elves nodded in agreement and put away their swords. The old elf extended his hand.
"Sergeant Drail of the Lady's First Guard, at your service."
His face broke into a broad grin. Peter liked the elf's smile. He shook his hand and smiled back.
"I'm Peter."
"This," the elf extended a hand toward the woman, "is the Lady Modron, daughter of Avalok, the Lady of the Lake, and the Queen of all Avalon."
A queen? Peter wasn't sure what a queen was, but judging by the way the elves treated her, it must be something important. He took a closer look. She appeared a bit frail to him, with her fine bones and long, thin neck, yet he sensed strength from her. Maybe it was the confidence in her stride, the way she glided through the forest, the way she looked at all things as though they belonged to her. She was elegant and graceful, but Peter thought her eyes a bit too far apart, her face too long, making her appear animalish, spooky even.
"So, Peter," Drail said, "how did a boy end up in the clutches of Ginny Greenteeth?"
"Who?"
Peter asked.
"The witch."
"He's not a boy," the lady said, appraising Peter. "See his ears? He has fairy in him."
"What is he then?" Drail asked.
The lady gave Peter another long look.
"He's a mystery, a most intriguing mystery."
She looked at Peter's chest.
"He's been marked."
Peter looked down at himself. He was covered in mud and blood. The cuts in his side were bleeding steadily. The bug stings were red and swelling, and the bite around his nipple was turning black. He'd been so intent on escape, he'd not even noticed. But now the wounds began to hurt, the one on his chest burning. His hand did too. He held out his palm. It was an angry red and dotted with white blisters. The lady bent down and lightly touched the edge of the bite wound. Peter flinched and sucked in a breath.
"Come," she said. "We need to take care of that, or the poison will spread."
She held out her hand. Peter hesitated.
"It's okay," she said.
Peter took her hand, and she led him up the trail. The elves fell in, three in front and three behind. Peter looked up at her as they walked. She smiled at him. Peter decided he liked holding hands with the queen, liked it very much. The trail led into a lush glade. At its center sat a circular pond surrounded by large, flat, white boulders. A gentle stream cascaded over the stones, sending a soft ripple across the pond's surface. The water was crystal clear. Peter caught sight of small, colorful fish chasing one another just below the surface. On second look, he noticed that they had the upper bodies of men and women. The winged wee folk skated across the surface as they zipped about, snatching bugs out of the air. The lady unhooked the clasp on her shoulder, letting her gown drop. She waded out into the pool until her fingertips touched the water. The sunlight glittered off the surface and danced along her gleaming white skin. She closed her eyes and raised her face to the sun.
basking in its warmth. She spoke a few words that Peter didn't understand and sank beneath the water. The elves spread out, perching among the surrounding rocks and watching the woods. Peter waited for the lady to surface. He waited a long time. No one could hold their breath that long. He glanced around at the elves, but none of them appeared concerned. He walked up to the bank, caught a flash beneath the water, and saw her, a silvery shape swimming like a fish around the pool. She bobbed up before him and gestured for him to come in. Peter took off his wolf pelt and tested the water with his foot. It was cool, but not cold, and felt good on such a warm day. He waded in to his waist and felt something tickling his ankles. The fish people were flittering around his feet, feeding on the silt. The lady took his hand and pulled him into the deeper water until his tiptoes could just touch the bottom. She drifted behind him, draping her arms over his shoulders. Peter stiffened.
"Let go of your fear, Peter," she whispered.
Peter took a deep breath, and she took him under, pulling him down to where the water was dark and cold. Peter could just make out the blurry rays of the sun dancing on the surface far above him. His lungs began to tighten, and he felt a twinge of panic. Her arms squeezed about him, and he thought of her sharp teeth. Did she mean to drown him? Her voice drifted to him, a muffled song resonating through the depths. The water began to warm around him. He felt a steady thumping, like a heartbeat, could hear the swish of blood through his own veins and arteries, and it was as though he was back in his mother's womb. His pulse began to slow, matching the rhythm, two hearts beating as one. His lungs no longer ached for air. He felt part of her, of the pool, the water itself, his lifeblood. Her voice, the faintest tickle in his ear.
"I am your forest, your earth, your eternity. I am your life. I am your death. I am all things forever and always. Love me. Love me. Forever love me."
He curled into a ball, a floating fetus with the pond his womb.
"Yes," he answered. "Forever."
The womb began to glow, growing brighter, then brighter. His head broke the surface. Peter spat out a mouthful of water and sucked in a deep lungful of air. He blinked against the sunlight.
Where was he?
Then he saw the lady, and nothing else mattered. She was the most perfect creature he could imagine, and he couldn't understand how he ever thought otherwise. His heart fairly strummed with her vision. All he wanted to do was gaze upon her forever. The lady examined him.
"The poison is gone," she said, looking satisfied. "The wounds will heal with time."
Reluctantly, Peter tore his eyes from her and glanced down at his chest. There was only the slightest pink trace of the bite mark left. The slashes in his side were closed, and the hundreds of insect stings had vanished. They got dressed and lay out upon a wide, flat stone to warm themselves in the sun. Peter was watching a heron drift by overhead when a host of hoots and howls burst from the trees. He sat up. A crew of long-armed creatures came swinging into the clearing. They were a bit larger than raccoons, black manes sprouting around their necks. Their small, dark eyes were close set and their snouts were long, reminding Peter a bit of wolfhounds. They scampered up to the far bank on short legs and knuckles, slurping noisily as they drank from the pond.
"What are those?"
"Barghest," the lady said.
"Be careful. They can be nasty if given the chance."
They'll certainly rob you of anything they can get their hands on.
The creatures hooted and barked as they drank. Peter cupped his hands to his mouth and mimicked their hooting. The Bargest fell silent, all of them staring at Peter. Peter jumped up and let loose several more hoots. The creatures erupted into a volley of irritated barking, the lot of them leaping away into the trees and disappearing into the woods. The lady laughed heartily, and the sound was music to Peter's ears.
"That's good, Peter. How'd you learn to do that?"
Peter shrugged, then began to mimic the whistles, hoots, chirps, and calls of the other animals. Soon all the creatures around the pond were cocking their heads quizzically at him. The lady laughed long and deep, and even the elves couldn't help but smile. A strange cry caught their attention. Peter saw a large bird with fiery red plumage glide across the pond and alight in a nearby tree. It surveyed the pond, its brilliant orange eyes standing out in stark contrast to a crown of black feathers. The lady let out a soft gasp and leaped to her feet.
"Peter," she whispered, "the sunbird."
It lifted its head and began to sing, and all the creatures in the forest fell silent. This wasn't just a call, but a song made up of whistles and chirps, like nothing Peter had ever heard before.
"Isn't it wonderful?"
she whispered. Peter nodded and glanced at the lady. She held her fingertips to her lips, her eyes captivated. As suddenly as it had appeared, the bird took flight and left them.
"Oh, don't go," she said, and sighed. "I've not seen it since I was a girl. That sweet song takes me back to happier times."
She was quiet then, her eyes distant. Peter caught a flash in the sun, and something landed on the sandy bank. He leaped up, raced over, and picked it up. It was a brilliant red feather. He brought it back and held it up for the lady to see. The sunlight shimmered off the fine filaments, and when he twirled it, it sparkled and glowed as though aflame. The sparkles glittered across the lady's face.
"Oh, Peter, it's beautiful."
He handed it to her.
"It's for you." "For me? Peter, no, you can't. It is too wonderful a treasure."
"Yes, I can."
She took the feather and began to twirl it. A smile of unabashed joy lit up her whole face, and in that moment, she looked like a little girl. Peter cupped his hands over his mouth and began to whistle and chirp, trying to mimic the sunbird's song. He didn't get it right, but after a few more tries, he had it and whistled the song all the way through. The lady stared at him in utter amazement, then grabbed his hand and clasped it in both of hers.
"That's wonderful. You must be part bird."
"Yes, I am," Peter said proudly. "Why, I'm a Peter bird."
"Well, Peter bird, you must come visit my court and sing for me. Is it agreed?"
Peter gave a big nod.
"Good."
She looked at him intently for a long time. Peter wasn't sure what to make of it.
"One more thing."
She reached behind her neck and undid the gold chain. She held it out so Peter could see the 8-point star. He noticed it was actually fine threads of tarnished gold spun around a dark stone.
"This belonged to another little boy, a very special little boy. He is lost to me. I would like for you to wear it for now. Would you do that for me?"
Again, Peter nodded. She slipped it around Peter's neck and kissed him atop his head.
"My little Mabon,"
she whispered, so quietly he almost missed it. As Peter held the star,
It began to glow slightly. The lady saw it too, and her eyes began to tear. She reached for Peter and pulled him tight, hugged him for a long time. She smelled of pollen and the sweetness of cool water. Peter heard her again in his head, or heart maybe, like in the pond.
"You are mine, mine forever."
"Yes," he answered,
"forever."
"Hey," Nathan called, "wait up." The child thief realized he'd let his mind drift, let the kid fall behind. He knew better, knew that the mist, given the chance, would get in his head and play games. "Stupid," he thought. "Careless and stupid." And now the boy was actually shouting in the mist. Peter waited, searching the shimmering wall of silvery light, listening. Had the Slua heard? Were they on their way?
"I don't like this," Nathan said. "Just where are we?"
Peter put his fingers to his lips.
"Shh,"
Peter whispered.
"You have to keep quiet or they'll hear. Now let's go."
"What are you talking about?" Peter didn't answer. Now wasn't the time for talk. He turned, searching for the path. It was there, just ahead, the thin golden thread sliding and shifting, drifting away as though blown by a hidden wind. You had to stay with the path, or it would leave you behind. Peter headed for the path, then realized Nathan wasn't following. The boy was staring at the ground.
"Look,"
Nathan said, pointing. Peter didn't need to look. He knew what it was.
"Those are bones. That's somebody's goddamn head."
Nathan squinted warily at Peter.
"What the hell kind of place is this?"
Peter jabbed his finger to his lips.
The kid had to be quiet. Had to. "Don't tell me to shh,"
Nathan said, raising his voice.
"I asked you a question. What the fuck kind of place is this?"
Peter gritted his teeth, tried to control his temper, but this kid was going to get them both killed. He glanced at the path. It was drifting away. He didn't dare lose sight of it, but they needed the kid. Peter stepped toward him. Nathan stumbled back, jerked a gun out, and pointed it at Peter. Peter halted.
"Stay the fuck away from me!"
the kid yelled. Peter heard the distant sound of children's laughter. His blood went cold. The laughter grew louder, joined by wails and moans, the cackling cries of old women. The mist began to stir. The kid snapped his head about.
"What's that, huh? What the fuck is that?"
The path drifted farther away. Another moment and it would be lost.
"Listen, Nathan,"
Peter said as calmly as he could.
"You have one chance. Follow me right now. Move or you'll never leave the mist."
But Nathan wasn't paying Peter any attention. He spun around, left, then right, holding the gun out in front of him, his eyes wide and terrified.
"Stay away from me!"
he screamed. The Slua came. First, the disembodied heads flying around, circling the boy, followed by the naked, craggy women, holding hands and skipping merrily about. Then the beasts, all shapes and sizes, their barks and howls, screams and growls, rumbling back and forth across the ghostly wasteland.
"Nathan!"
Peter cried.
"Come! Now!" "Oh my God!"
Nathan screamed and pulled the trigger over and over. But there was only a dry click as the hammer fell on the dead shells. The kid's face twisted into a mask of confusion and terror. Peter could have told him the gunpowder wouldn't work, not here in the mist. It never does. And even if the bullets had fired, they wouldn't have done a bit of good. The spirits, one and all, laughed.
the sound booming about the mist like thunder. The flying heads swarmed the boy, pecking at his hair. He ran, screaming, swinging the gun wildly, trying to fend them off as they chased him into the swirling wall of gray mist. Peter didn't shout to the boy again. It would do no good. Peter found the path and walked, his face tight, his eyes hard. He watched one foot after the other pound into the soft, powdery ground, and did his damnedest not to hear the distant echoes of Nathan's screams. Peter stumbled ashore and collapsed on the beach. He punched the sand again and again until his knuckles were raw, until he could no longer hear the boy's cries inside his head. He dug his fingers into the beach, came away with two handfuls of sand, turned and glared at the mist.
Why?
He screamed, and slung the sand into its swirling mass.
Why?
He screamed again, knowing the night would hear, the werebeasts and, worse, the flesh eaters. He didn't care.
Flesh eaters,
he spat.
Fucking flesh eaters. This is all because of them.
He bared his teeth at the mist. The glint of madness sparkled in his eye.
Someone, he whispered, needs to remind them to be afraid of the night.
Instead of heading into the swamps and back toward Deviltry, Peter turned and followed the coastline, making his way over the driftwood and rocks beneath the silvery glow of the low-hanging clouds, and it was not long before he heard the soft tread of something trailing him. Peter slid out his long knife and turned, shouting a challenge, daring the thing to show itself. Nothing did, or dared, his madness too plain, and Peter continued on alone until he saw the jagged timber walls of the fort lit up from within by a smoldering watchfire. He looked out toward the lagoon, to where the skeletons of the great galleons lay half-drowned, leaning off keel and rotting, their frames silhouetted against the silver glow of the mist like the ghostly bones of a sea dragon. He walked up to the fort wall, mesmerized by the dance of firelight between the jagged timber beams. Atop each of the gateposts sat a boy's head, their mouths frozen forever in the silent screams of the dead, their hair blowing in the brisk wind. The dark hollows of their eyes staring back at him, mocking him, accusing him. He counted 24 of them.
Jimmy, Mark, Davis, Bob, no, Bill? Which was it?
He started over again, then again. But no matter how many times he tried, he couldn't remember all their names. As his frustration grew, so did his volume, until he was shouting their names, knowing the flesh eaters would hear and not caring. He saw their shapes approach the wall, peering out into the darkness, felt their eyes searching for him.
Death has come,
Peter screamed,
to cut your throats and drink your blood.
He threw back his head and howled like a wolf. The gate opened. Dozens of flesh eaters carrying torches and wielding swords and axes stepped out. A figure pushed through them, a tall man wearing a wide-brimmed hat. He slid his sword from his belt, sliced the air with its long, narrow blade, and strolled forward. Peter slipped silently back into the shadows and disappeared into the night. Chapter 11. Bargest.
Ow! Ow!
Nick cried.
Just hold still, Cricket said. You're making it worse.
Nick grimaced. During the night, something, and Nick had a damn good idea what, judging by the pixies giggling from the rafters, had tied his hair to the bars of his cage.
Just one more. There, Cricket said. You know, you'll have to learn not to sleep with your head so close to the bars.
Nick sat up, rubbing his hair, and shot Cricket a cutting look. Thanks, but I think I figured that one out on my own.
Ew, someone's a sourpuss,
Cricket laughed, then stopped abruptly.
Whoa, you don't look so good.
Nick frowned. Thanks.
No, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, you don't look well. You feel okay?
I'm fine, Nick said curtly. Just had a bad dream, that's all. Nick waited his turn for the privy, stepped in, and took a hard look at himself in the mirror. Cricket was right. He looked bad. There were dark circles under his eyes, and his eyes looked haunted, his face oddly gaunt. He couldn't stop thinking about the nightmare. Unlike most nightmares, this one stayed with him. Not only could he clearly remember every detail, but he still harbored the ill feelings, the horror of what he'd seen and the terrible things he'd done. He knew it was silly, but he checked his hands, searching for any signs that they were turning black or growing claws. It had been that real. He doused his head with the cool water. It made him feel better, but didn't wash away his dread or the dark mood lingering in his chest. Nick almost ran into Sikiyu when he came out. She was busy refereeing breakfast and getting the fires going. Sorry, he said. She gave him a passing glance, stopped, stepped back, and looked at him again. She didn't seem so much concerned as disturbed. Nick, how do you feel?
Okay.
Sikiyu eyed him, skeptical.
You are sure?
Yeah, Nick said, a bit annoyed. I'm fine, really. Redbone came up behind Sikiyu and jabbed her in the butt.
Squaw, paleface need 'em powwow.
Sikiyu spun around, leading with her fist. Redbone was ready for her and leaped back, but she caught him on the arm so hard that even Nick flinched.
Ow, Jesus Christ, man!
Redbone cried, wincing and clutching his shoulder.
Jeez, I was just kidding around.
He shook his arm out. What do you want? Sikiyu snapped, looking ready to take his head off.
Nothing really, except to say we're running low on acorns and berries and mushrooms. Oh, and pretty much every other damn thing.
Redbone leaned over to Nick, still rubbing his arm, and whispered, She got her muscles from scalping white men, you know. He snorted and elbowed Nick, then did a double take.
Hey, wow. Cat, you don't look so good.
Nick frowned.
How did you sleep?
Sikiyu asked Nick.
Did you have any bad dreams?
The image of his skin turning black and his hands twisting into claws came to Nick. He was about to mention it, but didn't like the way the two of them were scrutinizing him, like he'd committed a crime.
No, he lied. My stomach hurt a little. That's all. I feel fine now.
Sikiyu and Redbone exchanged a wary glance. Neither looked convinced. Redbone slapped Nick on the back.
That's just your body getting used to the different food, man. That's all. It'll pass.
But Nick didn't miss the dark look Redbone shot at Sikiyu. It scared him. The next couple of days flowed into one another. Breakfast, training, dinner, sleep. Breakfast, training, dinner, sleep. Round and round. Nick did his best to stay out of Leroy's way, but the bigger boy took special pleasure in targeting him, taking every opportunity to give him a hard time. Nick tried not to let it get to him, losing himself in his training. He found the drills and long hours of practice to be the one place where he could forget his troubles. He also found he was getting pretty good with the staff and spear, his ability quickly outpacing that of both Cricket and Danny. His progress was encouraging, but more than anything, he wanted to beat Leroy, and worked tirelessly with Sikiyu, trying to master every move and trick. Soon he was pressing her to show him the advanced maneuvers he saw the devils performing. He wasn't sure if it was the exercise or the strange food, maybe both, but either way his body felt stronger, his timing and speed increasing with each passing day. The nights were the hardest, the dark dreams haunting his sleep. Each night in his nightmares, his skin would turn black and the dread and rage would grow in his chest. He would wake breathing hard, his stomach burning and murder in his heart. After breakfast on Nick's fourth morning, Sikiyu led him, Cricket, Danny, and Leroy over to the big round door on the far side of the hall. A few moments later, Redbone and the one-handed boy Abraham joined them, toting buckets and potato sacks. They'd put on leathers, tight-fitting, hand-stitched, single-piece garments with pointed boots sewn right into them, held up by a belt strapped high across the chest. Redbone tugged on a beat-up black leather jacket. This one wasn't hand-stitched. This was a genuine American motorcycle jacket, complete with spikes, patches, and "Sympathy for the Devil" painted in peeling red letters across the back. Redbone had a sly grin on his face. "Any of you cats up for a break?" Danny perked up.
"Hey, that'd be great."
"Good," Redbone said. "We're going on a little adventure." Nick didn't like the way Redbone said adventure.
"We are going foraging," Sikiyu said.
"Give you a chance to see some of the sights," Abraham added, and gave Redbone a wink. "Dirk and Dash are coming with us," Redbone said to Sikiyu. "Be here in a sec, just as soon as Dirk finds his sword."
"What? Again?" Abraham asked. "How do you lose a sword?
Kid would lose his butthole if it weren't attached to his ass." Redbone laughed out loud at that, showing all of his teeth. He seemed to always be wearing that wide, fierce grin. Nick felt that grin combined with the dye or paint or whatever it was he rubbed on his skin and hair to make it red made him look like a real devil. Then there was that ridiculous red bone, the one tied into the top knot of his wild, tangled hair, like something out of the Flintstones. Nick figured if he were to ask, which he had no intention of doing, that ridiculous bone would have something to do with his nickname. Up close, Nick couldn't help but notice all the scars on the boy, and wondered how many scrapes and challenges this whacked-out kid had been in. One particularly nasty-looking scar snaked lengthwise right down between his squinty, fiendish eyes. Abraham, other than his missing hand, had very few scars. It was his golden eyes that made him so striking, contrasting sharply with his dark skin. Nick didn't believe he'd ever seen a person as dark as Abraham. His skin was almost raven black. Abraham wore a scruffy bowler hat dressed up with black feathers and beads, and a tight-fitting pinstripe dinner jacket with the sleeves cut out. Two more boys joined them, one hopping along as he laced up his boot.
"Nick," Sikiyu said, "meet Dirk and Dash."
Dirk's scalp had been shaved. Jagged ritual scarring spun away from his eyebrows and along the side of his head. He was a bit shorter than Nick, square-jawed with a hefty build, reminding Nick somewhat of a bulldog. Dash pushed a clump of blonde hair from his face and stared down at Nick. He was almost as tall as Redbone, had a slight underbite, and a head full of long, greasy hair. Bits of bone and metal jutted from his ears, nose, eyebrows, nipples, and Nick didn't want to imagine where the hell else. Dirk and Dash cocked their heads from side to side and began to click their teeth.
"No,"
Sikiyu said and whacked Dash. Dirk snorted.
"Hey," Dash said and jerked a thumb at Dirk. "What about him?"
Sikiyu whacked Dirk. Dirk frowned and whacked Dash. Then the two boys were punching each other, and Redbone and Abraham had to separate them. Ignoring the ruckus, Sikiyu went to the wall and tugged over a basket of mangy-looking hides.
She handed one to each of the new blood. Put these on. Nick held it out before him, unsure just how one went about putting on a hide.
Just stick your head through that there hole, Abraham said, then added, they're for camouflage.
What are we hiding from? Nick wondered, but was afraid to ask. By the time Nick got the hide situated, Sikiyu handed him a belt. The belt looked ancient, the leather cracking and flaking. It was wide and studded with rings of tarnished brass. Nick noticed intricate swirling designs all but worn away from the years of abuse.
You have to earn the right to carry a sword, Sikiyu told them as she plucked four spears off the wall. For now, you are permitted spears.
Nick noted that the devils carried a long knife on their belts and a short sword slung across their backs. Dirk and Dash brought along spears as well. Sikiyu tossed Nick a spear. It was heavier than the practice spears, the staff a bit thicker. It felt smooth and true in his hand. He admired the sharp, jagged edge of the spearhead. Danny was staring at his spear with a sour face.
What do we need these for?
Nick could have answered that one, recalling the claw marks on the door.
In case we are attacked, Sikiyu said.
Attacked?
Danny stammered.
Huh? By what?
Monsters, Redbone said, his eyes serious. Sikiyu slid the bolt over and pulled the heavy round door inward. Nick was surprised to find himself eager to venture out. The last time he was out, it had been too dark to see anything, and the time he peeked out the door, well, he'd been too scared to see past his own shadow. But with all the devils coming along, all armed to the teeth, he didn't feel scared. He felt an odd excitement. He glanced at Redbone, Sikiyu, Abraham, Dirk, and Dash. They looked alert. Dangerous. Not a group he'd want to run into in the forest. They shuffled out single file, Nick following Redbone. He took in a deep breath, and the musky smell of damp earth filled his nostrils. He peered around the tall boy, eager to see the forest. The door thudded shut behind them, and the heavy bolt clacked into place. Nick stared at the deep claw marks on the door and swallowed loudly. He glanced up and realized that the fort, at least part of it, was actually in a tree, a huge tree that appeared to have grown right out of the stony cliff face, its thick roots and vines twisting around the boulders like a massive octopus. It towered above them, and he could see a few lookout stands here and there among the limbs. They crested a short slope, and Nick got his first clear look at the land of Avalon. He couldn't have told you exactly what he'd envisioned, but the scene before him wasn't it. Gray saturated everything, dull and ruddy, like the skin of something long dead. Where was the thick flowering undergrowth, the giant trees alive with purple monkeys and floating butterfly people, as in his dream? There were no magical creatures, not even a pixie. For that matter, there wasn't a sign of any living creature of any sort. Not so much as a bird or a bug. The landscape laid out before him was composed of barren, sooty earth and the carcasses of once mighty trees. Thorny vines snaked around jagged stumps, and huge briar patches formed daunting barriers in all directions. They marched over the rise and down a crooked, uneven trail, crawling over and under the fallen hulks of rotting trees. There came the occasional break in the low-hanging clouds, and Nick could make out steep, rugged cliffs just beyond the forest. Redbone fell in beside him, and they brought up the rear of the troop. He stared at Nick, that weird grin on his face. Nick smiled back once, hoping this would placate him. Redbone reminded Nick of the crazy folks that talked to you on the street, the ones you quickly learned it was best not to make eye contact with. A dense fog swept across the trail, momentarily obscuring the path. Redbone began making low ghost sounds.
Silence,
Sikiyu called from the front of the troop. Redbone stopped at once, but his crazy grin never wavered. He gave Sikiyu a Zig Heil salute and winked at Nick. As they moved along the path, Nick noted a few trees, usually the larger ones, that still held a bit of green in their uppermost branches. Curiosity got the best of him, and he asked Redbone in a hushed whisper,
"Is the forest dying?"
"Man, all of Avalon is dying," Redbone answered, seemingly pleased as punch that Nick wanted to talk. "They call it the Scourge. Even in the short time I've been here, I've seen this forest go from a thing of beauty to the way it is now. Each time we go out for berries, seems we got to trek farther and farther north."
"How long you been here?"
"Man, that's hard to say. Time's different here, you know. I do know it was 1974 when I left the human world."
"Whoa.
That's nothing. That cat Abraham, he left the human world way back during the Civil War. He used to be a slave."
Nick looked at Abraham, disbelieving.
"No way." "Yup. And if you think that's way out, dig this. Sikiyu has been here since the Pilgrims. She was a slave of the Delaware tribe. Peter stole her right out from under their big fat noses. Abraham told me that when he first arrived, this whole forest was still teeming with all sorts of magical little beasties, even the wee folk. Look at it now, man. That's hard to believe."
Nick saw something move in the mist, a dark, skittering shadow about the size of a rat.
"That's a darkling," Redbone volunteered. "From what I'm